What did you get from your mother or your father? Coming up in this hour, some stories from people who, after a parent died, found something left behind that deepened their understanding or learned something about themselves that they hadn't seen before. Words and music today for commandment number 6, honor thy father and thy mother. Stay tuned. We start Stay Human today with a daughter honoring her famous father. She brought him to tears, in fact, when she performed this back in 1996 at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts.
Roseanne Cash.
My father is a man of many paradoxes. He was raised on a farm, informed by hard manual labor, and he emerged a poet with a powerful, resonant voice. He was brought up a Baptist, and yet he has the soul of a mystic. He's lived a hard life, a tough life, and yet he has a sensitivity to beauty and elegance and children that is beyond compare. The tie that binds all of these things together is Johnny Cash, the songwriter. And as a songwriter, he is profoundly original. This is the song that defines him more than any other, his signature song, and the song that he sung every concert for the last 40 years. I want to do this for you, Dad.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds, because you're mine. I walk the line. I find it very, very easy to be true. I find myself alone when each day is through. Yes, I'll admit that I'm a fool for you, because you're mine. I walk the line. You've got a way to keep me on your side. You give me cause, love that I can't hide. For you I know I'd even try to turn the tide, because you're mine. I walk the line. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds, because you're mine. I walk the line, because you're mine. I walk the line.
You're tuned to Stay Human on Northern Community Radio, KAXE KBXE. My name is Michael Goldberg. Teenagers might be surprised to hear this, but I'm finding that getting old brings me some deep relief. In particular, you tend to be more forgiving of yourself just because you've been around so long. You know how much you've been wrong so often, and still here we are. It's a relief, and it's a gift too, because seeing yourself more clearly, forgiving yourself, makes it possible to be more forgiving of others, including one's parents. My friend Terry O'Brien offers us this story about how she learned to stand up for herself.
I was a dramatic child who sobbed and sulked and could easily carry out a week-long pout. you can still catch a glimpse of this behavior when I move to argue a point, say the unfairness of a situation, or something I believe strongly, and especially when I'm compelled to defend criticism of myself. I get louder. I stand and stride about, punctuating my points with my hands. I embody the very definition of strident, a word that I am convinced was coined by a man and is sometimes applied appallingly by other women to discredit women who speak too fervently, too forcefully. Passionately, I counter. Too plainly, I've been told. It's on these occasions when I am likely to declare a bit dramatically, I was raised to stand up for myself and for what I believe in. None of which is literally true. No one in my family, neither parents nor grandparents, ever said such a thing to me. In my Roman Catholic upbringing, there were the Ten Commandments, of course, and the Golden Rule, as well as do your homework, get good grades, go to college, get your degree, then marry well. And to her young adult non-conforming doubters, our mother's last word on the subject, once a Catholic, always a Catholic. Not a lot of advice was given, nor confidences shared. She was a staunch Catholic and Democrat, a member of the League of Women Voters, and a big fan of Hubert Humphrey. We kids generally knew our mother's stance on an issue. Dad, however, was a cipher. He was a convert to Catholicism, my mother's and the church's doing, and, we suspected, a Republican. His career was electrical engineering, his projects always highly classified. Mother was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when she was in college. My parents moved to the Southwest, where it was thought the dry heat would be advantageous to her illness. The dryness, yes, the heat, not at all. We lived in a triplex outside of Las Cruces, New Mexico. Across miles of desert, the Oregon Mountains were silhouetted against an even broader sky. "See that red spot out there?" one older neighbor boy taunted. "That's blood." At 4 years old, I wasn't hard to scare. The next-door neighbors caught male and female black widow spiders and kept them in a mason jar until the one ate the other. When I was still in my crib, I watched a centipede crawl across the bedroom floor, and a friend of Mother's found a scorpion in her purse when looking for her sunglasses. And the irrigation ditch that paralleled our road? Our parents were unanimous in warning us to stay away from it. If there's water in it and someone falls in, they could drown. We were kids in southern New Mexico whose families enforced a daily siesta during the heat of the day. There was no community pool for us to walk or bike to. The ditch fascinated us and drew us to its banks. That's where I learned to stand up for myself, in the irrigation ditch. Older kids dragged a plank to the bank side and spanned the ditch. Then it became a contest, a dare. Who can walk the plank from one side to the other without falling in? My older sister could. Everyone could. But me, that warped plank, how it sagged in the middle and bounced with every tentative step I took. I fell in. I screamed and flailed in the water. The screen door to our apartment banged open. Mother emerged, coming to my rescue as fast as she could, which wasn't very fast. She could still walk then, but because of her MS, her right leg dragged. Her progress across our scrubby lawn was alarmingly slow. Had this been a scene in a Woody Allen movie, this is the moment when my 4-year-old self turns to the camera and declares, I knew then, and for always, that she would never make it in time. Mother could not save me. I would have to rescue myself. But wait, if I was down in the ditch, still floundering in the dank water, one gulp away from death by drowning, how could I have seen her coming? The truth is, my feet had found bottom. I was standing in the ditch, sopping wet, still bawling, but standing. I had already saved myself. I suppose someone, somewhere, has written a book about chronic illness and the ways in which it becomes the center of a family, how illness and its bitter lessons defines the afflicted and their family members. When I trot out my statement about being taught to stand up for myself and what I believe in, while I can't say that anyone in our household made a point of telling me this, I believe that my parents embodied this principle. If our mother's religious faith ever wavered, she didn't say so. And even when she couldn't make it to the polls, she voted. Dad never criticized me for participating in peace marches, and I never hassled him about the missiles he helped develop or the anti-personnel devices that his company manufactured. Defense contracts paid the bills. A lesser man might have abandoned his family, daunted by the rounds of hospitalization, the medical expenses, the neediness, the shrill tone of illness's voice. Quoting Shakespeare, as she was wont to do, "Our father was our mother's sweet prince." The axe fell for my dad when he was in his 40s and we were living in Minnesota. Parkinson's. My older sister found out incidentally and told the rest of us kids. Our parents were the halt leading the lame. Both were battered, beat down, and I say this without exaggeration, bludgeoned each by their own neurochemistry. Ultimately, neither could stand unaided. Yet they withstood all that was thrown their way until their final moments. What I mean to say with my mantra about standing up is embraced and more eloquently expressed in another speech from Hamlet that Mother frequently quoted. Act 1, Scene 3. Polonius, father to Ophelia and Laertes, recites a long list of advice for his young son who is about to embark for France. It includes the familiar, "Neither a borrower nor a lender be," but the part that has stuck with me comes at the end of this litany. "This above all, to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day. Thou canst not then be false to any man." My true self in my late 60s is, I like to think, a little less histrionic than when I was a kid. I'm more of a listener now, yet still I feel deeply and sometimes am moved to speak passionately. Polonius's advice. Although I'd heard it dozens of times, I had to look up the exact wording. My mother learned it in school. She knew the lines by heart.
That's Terry O'Brien. You can hear more of her stories on upcoming editions of this program. Rock on.
Yeah.
shovels and rope, c'est la vie, say the old folks. It strikes me that remembering and honoring our parents is not just a personal matter. It's not private only. As a moral commandment or as a psychological necessity, honoring those who have come before us is fundamental to social well-being as well as our moral or psychological health. As I ask friends to tell me what they've received from their parents, I find myself wanting to honor their parents too. And it's true for everyone. To know where we are, we have to recognize and appreciate those who came before us. In 2005, recently elected to the U.S. Senate, Barack Obama gave a commencement address, part of which addressed the question, "What is your place in history?" Here's what he said. "What will be my place in history? In other eras across distant lands, this is a question that could be answered with relative ease and certainty. As a servant of Rome, you knew you would spend your life forced to build somebody else's empire. As a peasant in 11th century China, you knew that no matter how hard you worked, the local warlord might take everything you had, and that famine might come knocking on your door any day. As a subject of King George, you knew that your freedom to worship and speak and build your own life would be ultimately limited by the throne, and then America happened. A place where destiny was not a destination, but a journey to be shared and shaped and remade by people who had the gall, the temerity, to believe that against all odds they could form a more perfect union on this new frontier. And as people around the world began to hear the tale of the lowly colonists who overthrew an empire for the sake of an idea, they came. Across the oceans and the ages, they settled in Boston and Charleston, Chicago and St. Louis, Kalamazoo and Galesburg to try and build their own American dream. This collective dream moved forward imperfectly, and yet, brick by brick, rail by rail, calloused hand by calloused hand, people kept dreaming and building and working and marching and petitioning their government until they made America a land where the question of our place in history is not answered for us, but by us." That's Barack Obama back in 2005. I love that, brick by brick, rail by rail, calloused hand by calloused hand. When you think of your own parents with that fine grain of physical effort, and you think of the results, not just of their individual labor, but of the shared results, it helps you see more connections between their lives and yours, honoring their works with ours.
Took your kiss I built America.
That's U2 with the theme song to Martin Scorsese's great movie, The Gangs of New York. It might be one of his best movies. I just recently rewatched it, and it's so brilliant, about honor and betrayal. DiCaprio plays a warrior seeking to avenge his father's death. Though I'd seen it before, I have to say, I definitely saw more this week when I watched it again on TV. A lot of movies reward a second or third look. That's why I'm always glad to hear from Jack Nachbar, our professor of pop culture. He's seen them all, and he'll watch them again. This week, he tells us a little bit about how he got that way.
My father died in 1960, when he was just 55. I was 19 and stupid. I grieved for the kind, decent man who'd taken me hunting and played catch with me on warm summer evenings. But at age 19, I decided that I had little in common with my father. He was a businessman and anti-union. I had a factory summer job and was pro-labor. He was a Republican. I campaigned for John Kennedy. In his spare time, he enjoyed making furniture. I had 10 thumbs. He worked 6 days a week and often came home exhausted. His schedule left little time for anyone, including me. 20 years later, I walked into a college classroom to teach a course on silent movies. I was nuts about old films from the 19-teens and 20s. It became one of my favorite courses. Then I taught courses on movies of the 1930s and 40s. I taught courses on musicals and gangsters and westerns. It was much more than just doing my job. Talking about these old pictures was a discovered treasure. It was like I had come home to something happy in my soul. About age 40, 20 years after my father's passing, I was a little less stupid than when I was 19. I began to ask myself why I was the way I was. Specifically, why was I so crazy about classic Hollywood movies? Then the light bulb finally went on. Surprise! The answer was my dad. Yep, the same person I'd written off in my late teens as distant and pretty much irrelevant. My parents both liked going to the movies. When I was 5, they started taking me with them. First up, the Harvey Girls with Judy Garland. then Pinocchio, and a bit later, a revival of The Wizard of Oz. A year later, they took me to my first Westerns, a Roy Rogers and Gene Autry double feature. Wow! By the next year, I was a devoted Saturday afternoon screen worshiper at the Nokomis, a dingy little theater in South Minneapolis. It always featured Westerns. Sometimes my friends and I would sit through the movies twice. I'd walk home in the dark and eat supper, telling my mom and dad all about the dream frontiers I'd seen on the screen. They never made fun of these rehashed fantasies. Quite often it was our only serious conversation of the week. When my dad got home from work, he and I would occasionally talk for a few minutes while he changed his clothes. I realize now what a special time for me that was. We talk about movies he'd seen. He told me about sex god Rudolph Valentino in the 1922 notorious The Sheik, and the great chariot race in the 1926 Ben-Hur. He told me about the 1934 It Happened One Night, and how Claudette Colbert used her leg instead of her thumb to hitchhike. He told me about the Marx Brothers, his comedy favorites. He told me about a 1949 Clark Gable picture, Any Number Can Play. I went to see it, and later that evening we had a good discussion about what the film meant. Once, when I was about 9, he let me stay up late to watch Orson Welles' Macbeth on TV. It was my introduction to Shakespeare. I was wowed, like when I first saw Roy and Jean. It led to several days of two brief talks. Over the years, my dad told me about dozens of movies, and each time I could feel how pleasantly they sat in the corners of his imagination. Dad never laughed at me when I gave childish opinions about the movies I'd just seen. His own description made clear how much he liked going to movie theaters and that there was nothing silly or unworthy about what he saw there. These enthusiasms and positive attitudes, I realized 20 years after his death, he passed on to me, and they became a favorite part of who I am. My father and his movies, they gave me a cornerstone of both my leisure and my professional life. I didn't think about it in 1960, but I realize now how much after his death I missed our movie chats. I still miss them. And when I see a good movie, I imagine the tone of my father's voice in our little film talks more than half a century ago. It's the sound of happy memory, and it's the sound of love.
Jack Nachbar. Coming up on today's show, finding a diary, finding an archive from a parent after they're gone. But first, for Jack and his dad, here's the theme music from Frank Capra's It Happened One Night.
Thank you.
Music by David Amram, performed by David Sanborn. That was written for the movie The Manchurian Candidate. That is not the kind of mother-son relationship this show is about, though. You're tuned to Stay Human, heard at this time every week on KAXE KBXE. Thanks to the listener members who keep us on the air. We also receive support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. On this week's show, we have stories about the ways people honor their parents, honor their works, honor their gifts, honor their voices. Here's Gail Otteson telling about something that her mother left to her.
It's one of these little five-year diaries where you get about an inch with four lines to write, you know, on a page that's probably 4 inches wide. I think she wrote in this from the age of 16 to 20, and it started in 1936. My parents had all this old stuff saved out in the garage, and my mother died when she was 86, and when she was 85, she started going through some of that stuff, and she found this diary, and she was just thrilled. And the surprising thing is, after she read it, she wanted me to have it. She wanted me to read it. It's a total treasure to me. My mother died 15 years ago, and I'm an adult, but I had this little girl feeling of, oh, look what she's writing about. It's so cool. So, you know, and I was looking through it. There's a lot about blizzards. They lived on a farm in southern Minnesota, so there were a lot of blizzards. A whole week where they'd have no school. They had a little car, and when they all got to be teenagers, they got to drive the car into school on days when the bus didn't show up. And they were in 4-H, and they had parties, and they went to the movies in Olivia, which is where she grew up, and they went swimming at Green Lake. And she writes a lot about movies, a lot. They would go in as often as they could. And then she meets my father during this 4 or 5 year period as well, who moved onto a farm next door. Of course, I wondered if I would be surprised by anything in this book, because I knew my mother for a long time. But a diary is a diary. So I did find one thing. She writes, oh, one night Glenn, that was my dad's name, and Pat, his brother, came up and got me and Eleanor, and we went to Bird Island to the show. It was good. And Glenn held my hand all the way home, believe it or not. I like him because he's different than the average run, it seems to me. And yes, I really do sort of like him. Sunday evening, we all went to see Mr. Smith Goes to Washington in Olivia. It was a perfect movie with Jimmy Stewart and Jean Arthur. We had malted milks afterward and really had an awfully good time. Glenn is really very likable and can make himself very agreeable. Too much so, because I guess I just can't get the kid off my mind. Guess he's, quote, got something girls like. Although he's awfully little. And that's the part. My dad was shorter than my mother, and it bothered her, at least at first. And that was a surprise. It's just a personal diary of a teenage girl who's growing up. And she starts out just saying all the stuff that's happening. But by the time she's 20 and she's in her last year, I have to read this part to you, because this is really what diaries are about. She says, another new year, the last year for this diary. It's a sort of topsy-turvy diary, too, and some of the things seem so dreadfully silly now, but they didn't seem a bit silly at the time, not one bit. The first half of this diary, I was in high school. That seems so long ago now, but it really isn't that long. I just seemed like such a kid then, and I guess I really haven't outgrown it that much. I've outgrown a lot of things, though, and it almost scares me sometimes. I think I really don't care. To think that I don't really care for the same things that I used to care about, I cared so intensely then about some things, and I thought I could never get along without them, and that I'd simply die if I couldn't always have them. And now they seem so childish. I wish I understood it, but I just don't understand a lot of things, and least of all, myself. I'm the worst thing to try and understand. That's a diary, right? And I was very, very close to my mom. So this is a treasure for me. I keep it next to my bed. And every once in a while, I'm there and buy a picture of her. And periodically, I just open it to a page And I read it, and I've never actually read the entire thing. So I'm discovering little parts of it here and there, and it keeps, she's in my life. It's I'm very lucky.
Thanks to Gail Otteson for sharing that. I want to play a song for her mom, Gwen Otteson, who was in the high school class of 1938, a hit tune from that year, updated here by Kermit Ruffins.
gonna drop that me, 'cause my hair is curly, just because my teeth are pearly, just because I always wear a smile, like to dress up in the lady style, 'cause I'm glad I'm living. Take troubles all with a smile, just because my color shady, different maybe, that's why they call me Dumpy Bitty Button, Bubba Bitty Button. My hair is good, oh, my teeth are pretty, just because, oh, baby, oh, baby.
That's why they call me Shine. I know, that song doesn't have anything to do with the theme of today's show, except sometimes when I'm shining, when I am kind of feeling like the guy in that song, I remind myself of my father, especially at a party or something, all dressed up and on a roll, telling stories and asking questions that got people telling theirs. I have a few letters that he wrote, but nothing like a diary. Our last story today about honoring those who came before us is from my friend Karen Noyce, about a gift from her father, Gaylord Brewster Noyce.
My dad died on August 10th, 8 years ago, 2009. My mom died August 10th of this past summer, 8 years to the day after Dad. And as we've been downsizing her things over the last year, I think we ran across this box in March of this year when we were moving her into an assisted living place, room, out of her somewhat larger apartment. She wanted us to take it and go through it and at some point make some sense out of this one box, the materials in it, and send them back to the university where he taught. The box focused on one event that he had participated in May 23rd, 1961. Dad was a congregational minister in Raleigh, North Carolina, from 1954 to 1960. And in 1960, he moved us, we all moved up to New Haven, Connecticut, where he took a position at the Yale Seminary. But in the spring of 1961, the chaplain of Yale, Bill Coffin, put out an invitation to faculty and students in the area to join him to get on a bus. It was in the immediate aftermath of the first group of Freedom Riders who were Well, one bus was burned, and the next bus, the riders were beaten. And the idea was, let's get some people from the north down there to show that this is not just a local thing. Let's get the support in there. So as it turned out, there were five people, my dad being one of the five, who went down. And they ended up being arrested only 2 days into their ride. So this folder just has a lot of letters from their old parishioners, people from college, people they didn't know, instigated some hate mail, and notes and newspaper articles that people sent from all over the world and all over the country. One from a classmate of his in high school saying, "You are a long-lost classmate. I read about you. I was both shocked and surprised to see your name in the recent turmoil of our country. Just didn't sound like the quiet little boy I knew back in Grinnell. I think the North has its own trouble to rectify without sending its residents to the South to cause trouble." Then, too, the world is full of prejudice. You know, she goes on to say, you know, "I've lived in the South now for a while, and if you really want to help, if you really want to help the Negro, people should invest their bus fares into a fund for educational purposes and for higher moral standards." I mean, it's just, it's amazing some of the things that were written. So he wrote back to her, and he says, "What a surprise to hear from you, for I am indeed your former classmate of Grinnell High School. I think it would be fair to say that I am still a fairly quiet guy. Although occasionally convictions about both the Christian faith and the moral problems of democracy, which were learned as much at Grinnell as anywhere else, carry me into disagreement with some of my fellows. I hope you have come to love the South as much as we did during our years in a southern parish. We have just moved north for this job as of last September." He concludes, "Back again to the issue we were discussing. You must know that segregation is something we have to work on, just as we worked on it in our Southern Church in many ways, for it is probably the chief handicap for our international prestige at the present time. Moreover, there is certainly unanimity among the churches, both Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish, as to the moral position we must take on this brotherhood question. All the best to you and yours." The people that wrote to him in support, some of the letters back and forth, people adored him. He was this very, very just humble, completely guileless man who would just say things that he would just say his truth with and have kind of this surprise. He always had this degree of curiosity and surprise in his questions to people. And he would cut right through with these questions that, you know, kindly and innocently delivered, that sometimes we'd raise our eyes at, like, wow, he's asking that. But he had no qualms about just getting right to the heart of the matter and saying, well, what are you thinking about that? And what do you make of this? I was six. I was just finishing first grade. And I was very aware of it. When we had been in Raleigh, which I loved, I was born there. I lived there. I was very upset about moving away from Raleigh at almost 6 years old. My dad's church, in leading that church, he worked with a Black Baptist church in town to run an integrated summer camp, kids summer camp, and to hold cooperative programs. Martin Luther King came to speak one night. There were potlucks together and things like that. And this was kind of right in the center of the South. I wasn't all that aware of how hot a topic this was, but I knew that there was something special about that. And I have real vague memories of being in the basement of this other church with all these interesting people around and, you know, the casseroles and having a potluck. And I don't know if that was when Martin Luther King came to speak or what, but I was aware of who he was. So a year later, when Dad went back to the South, it was very much something I was aware of as a very, you know, kind of a courageous thing to do, and I was very, very proud of him.
Sure.
Even though I was aware of this, and even though for years I had this little phrase that I always could hold as my own, which was a kind of helped me identify myself, which was, my father was a freedom rider. You know, silly as it is, I carried that little thought with me for years as a child. But even though you know all that, it's remarkable how little we know of who our parents are and what their daily thoughts and lives consist of when we're children. We just go about our stuff, and they're there around the edges, and they're there at the core, but we don't walk with them. You know so little. The things going on in a marriage, the hard decisions, so much of that is outside of or kept away from the kids. But then as you look through this and start to really understand from the perspective of an adult and all the years you've lived and things you've experienced as an adult, you start to see this in a truer light, perhaps. You know, you think, wow, have I done my dad justice? You know, have I made my voice clear enough? Have I had anything close to the courage that he had? All of those things. Which luckily I still have a few years left maybe, and I can say, well, how will I live the rest of my life?
Karen Noyce lives in Warbo, Minnesota, and among other things, serves on the Itasca County Human Rights Commission. Thanks to her and to Terry O'Brien, Jack Nachbar, and Gail Addison for being part of today's show. And thanks to you for being part of it too. My name is Michael Goldberg with Stay Human. What else are you gonna do?
Same old thing and hoping to change. Using the Lord to make the people insane. Feeding the rich to take from the poor. And those about to help, they only seem to ignore. We cry, but
we don't give up now.
Sometimes we don't.
We don't give up now.
We come to learn the only help is within. God first and then to love your fellow man. And when it seems you're only walking in rain, look to the sky and call on his name. We cry, but
we don't give up now.
Sometimes we don't. Sometimes
we don't give up now.
No, we don't give up now. We don't.
help me say that we don't.
We don't.
Oh, Lord.
We don't give up now.
Though it may be hard sometimes.
We don't.
We don't.
We don't give up.
No.
We don't care.